Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So last weekend we had our public Vesak celebration with Tanajan Dan and his Ajahn Teja Panyo and the lay people, and that went off very, very well. That was a very nice time with them, and to Niagara, saw the falls and the apple blossoms and tulips. It was perfect. And then we took them to Ayas. They enjoyed being there. So it was a very, very rewarding trip, I think, for all of us. The official Vesak, of course, is the full moon of May, which was last night, according to this the calendar we use. And so we, in the monastery, those of you who might not be aware, we do a longer period of practice around the full moon and the new moon. So we try to sit till 12 o'clock, so we sat up till 12 o'clock last night. So if ever you want to put an extra few hours on a cushion, you're always welcome. It might sound a bit, I don't know if it sounds difficult, but it's actually a very peaceful time because we don't really do much except walk and sit and sit and walk. And so you get a longer period of meditation. And those, if you're not too exhausted, of course, and you don't have to work the next day, etc., those are very fruitful times because you're constantly engaging in the practice of awakening, even though you might be falling asleep, engaging in the practice of establishing mindfulness in the present moment. And it has a cumulative effect. So you're always welcome to come. It's not the most popular number we have here. You're always welcome to come. It's on our calendar. So Vesak, in Asia, it is it's one of the big celebrations in all our monasteries, and usually in Thailand the monks would sit up all night, and there'd be Dharma talks right through the night. And it's one of the traditions that I don't know if it existed before Ajahn Chah, must have in some way, but many lay people would gather. So at Walpapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, I'm sure there'd be a thousand people there last night. And everyone would come, take the 8 precepts, and might stay for the day. And then they would come together in the evening and do the puja, the chanting, and then probably Lompo Liam, the abbot, would give a talk. And then right through the night, other monks would give talks, and people would be meditating outside inside. Sometime during the night, they would do a circumambulation, Vientiane in Thai. And the last time I did that for Vesak at Wat Pho Phong was many, 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 many years ago, but I think there were 2,000 people. That was way back then. And we all had candles and incense, flowers, and we circumambulated in single file around the central part of the monastery. It's very beautiful, the full moon. It's the hot season now in Thailand, so the evenings are doable. Doable. So it's quite nice. Full moon, lots of faith, silence, people walking in silence. So it has a very devotional quality. And when you get such a large group of people who have faith, who love the teaching, who are really working at the practice and have that kind of sincerity about the practice, it's uplifting because it's a whole community, a large community doing this and paying reverence. So we'll get there. I think eventually I'd like to maybe do that, the circumambulation. Get that ceremony going. So some of these more ceremonial parts of Buddhism come come a bit slower, take a body of people to do that. But they have a kind of heart quality which is, I think, very, very important to plug into. They bring up faith, they bring up a sense of community. And they're very, very simple. There's nothing happening. There really is. It's not like you're going to the fair and you're going to get a candy floss or whatever. It's just very simple. People coming together, being silent, contemplating the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha. And these very simple gatherings and contemplations uplift the heart in ways that the intellect can't do. When we celebrate Vaisak, we usually think, as you know, of the three events in his life: the birth, the enlightenment, and what we call the Parinibbana, the final passing of Buddha. And so last night I read a rendition of that. Listen to the story of the Buddha. And it's a good story to read over and over again. It's a quite inspiring story. And as Ajahn Sumedho would often teach, he says, birth and death, all of us are going to experience. And the purpose of human birth, what are people for? One of the purposes of human birth is to realize that in-between bit, enlightenment. Because if you're born, death is inevitable. But enlightenment isn't inevitable. It's something that is a possibility. The tradition has it that the Buddha's birth took place in a full moon of May. His final passing took place in a full moon of May, and his enlightenment took place on a full moon in May. So it's obviously an important, significant time for us. Whether it happens so or not, we don't know, but there's a lot of symbology in that. Human life is this kind of curious, isn't it? Like I don't remember asking being born. I don't know about you. Sometimes I even resented my parents. It's your fault. On a bad day, sometimes I would be really grateful to them. But for whatever reason, we're here, we're conscious, we're human beings, we have the capacity to reflect. And then I think that in itself, at some point in our lives, there is a sense of, it's a search for meaning for some people, for some maybe not, but I think for most people there is the kind of sense of, well, so why? Well, what is it all about? Is it just about going to work and having fun or surviving? Or, you know, is there a more profound reason for, or possibility for human birth? And the Buddha would say, yes, there is a profound possibility, and that is freedom from suffering. And that certainly, I think, has struck us all. That's why we're here. So that even our difficult times and the human suffering that we have can be meaningful. They can be meaningful. Not that they're not painful, not that they're not difficult, but they can become meaningful because they are instructive. They teach us in some way about something that we're attached to and something we need to understand about ourselves and something we need to let go of. So even in the midst of, tragedy, there's a possibility of meaning. One of the words that I always enjoy in the recitations that we do on the qualities of a Buddha is the word Lokavidu, the knower of the worlds. And so sometimes that's referred to as the kind of clairvoyant powers of a Buddha, the knower of the worlds. And so his power of clairvoyance, he could see into other levels of consciousness and so forth. But as contemplatives, that word Lokavidu can also be used as in a much more immediate and direct and meditative way. And so in this case, the world is the arising of a sense of a self, of a sense of a me and a world, a sense of a history, of a sense of a time, past, and future. And that arises according to causes and conditions. And it's simply a mental formation, but it can seem so very real. So for example, I might, if I have some resentment or something or some worry that the energy of, say, the resentment or the worry comes into consciousness. And as it comes into consciousness, one sense of attention isn't very strong, or one believes in that, then the worry becomes the world, doesn't it? What am I going to do, and what's going to happen, and I don't know, and what if I do this, and what if I do that? And that's the birth of the world. It arises in consciousness. But that's very much dependent on causes and conditions. And so the world ends. So the worry is solved, or another kind of energy comes up. I get excited about something, or angry at something. Another kind of a world arises. So maybe then, if I'm going on a negative, no, if it takes something positive, say I have the chance to do something very, very interesting, go for a travel in an exotic country, and someone has invited me, and I start to plan. And there's me in the future, and what I'm going to do, and how nice it's going to be, and the clothing I'm going to buy, and the kinds of places I'm going to see. And so the world gets born in that way. Not that that's wrong or bad, but it's different than just like planning. Like worry in this case is different than planning, in the sense worry in this sense is when there's a strong sense of self, some sense of me and mine. So the world gets born into consciousness and then ceases. So to see the end of the world is one of the very important practice, to see the end of the world, not as Armageddon, annihilation, end of all ends, not that, but actually when that sense of me and the world ceases in the mind, when something like, let's say, resentment, say maybe there's some kind of a past injustice that has happened, or a past misunderstanding that has happened, and one perceives it as an injustice, and that keeps coming up into the mind. And then the mind says, well, I'm going to tell them this, and I'm going to tell them that, and it's not fair. And one begins to notice that, oh, that's just a thought. That's just a perception. That's the world. And in that noticing of the world, actually the world stops. You might not notice it, but there's a kind of ending of the world. And one becomes more deliberate in that kind of a practice. When, like, you notice the mind doing, creating through worry or fantasy or whatever, and you say, no, that's just the world, or not true, or delusion, or not self, or whatever words you want to use, and you just don't go there. Don't go there. And as you don't go there, you see, well, that ended. The world just ended. I do that a lot with the out-breath. I do that a lot. If my mind is churning up something because I've been stimulated by, it usually happens, one gets stimulated by something negative or positive, and then the mind wants to, you know, the habits of mind want to create a world, I use the end of the out-breath. That's very good. I let the out-breath go and just wait at the end of the out-breath. No world. And that doesn't mean that nothing's happening, that there isn't consciousness, but it's that whole sense of self, me, mine, the storyline, the narrative, driven by these powerful forces. So the end of the out-breath, and just know the end of the out-breath, end of the world. And then just wait. So you begin to not be born in the world. Begin to see the world as conditioned phenomena that arise, stay for a while and then cease. And you begin to kind of have an appreciation for the end of the world, the silence between thoughts, the silence after you've noticed the scenario that's playing up into the mind. And this is a practice to be done. It's not so very, very far away, but we don't tend to notice it because we tend to be very, you know, habitually caught up into our thinking minds, planning or organizing, worrying, fearing, resenting, and so on. So to be quite deliberate. Now, when we start to do that, then you start to have the sense of these two words I like to use a lot about around presence, awareness, is watchful and available. These two words I find very helpful in thinking about awareness or mindfulness practice. So if I'm sitting here and my mind is preoccupied about what I'm going to do tomorrow, or preoccupied about something that happened in the past and now I'm reviewing it, replaying it, then I'm not watchful or available. But if I just notice that and I just say, oh, that's the world, and maybe I just listen to the sound of the fan, I use another sense base other than thought, I use the sound of the fan and I just listen, then I become watchful, available. And that's where the world ends. The world ends in awareness. The world ends in that space of silence. But I have to learn to appreciate that and come to that and know that. And I can do that. I can do that by picking up another sense base. So I can just listen to the sound of the fan. And in the listening, I know it's watchful and available. You have to be available. So if the mind is sleepy or worried or resentful, it's not available and it's always thinking. It's caught in the world, so you're reborn in the world. So to use other senses, to use the other sense bases to see color, say. So if you're walking through the woods and your mind is churning up some complex problem, whatever, to actually just stop and look at green. And then remember, watchful, available. Come to the present moment. Eating food. You're eating something and the mind is planning what it's going to do tomorrow and whatever. You just taste the curry, just the taste itself. So by using other sense bases, where we're not just proliferating and creating, we begin to incline the mind to that which is peaceful, because the world is not peaceful. The world is endlessly changing and endlessly driven by all manner of negative and positive things. And the sense of ego and the sense of self is very unsatisfactory, as you might have noticed by now. So to actually do that and to sustain that sometimes requires tremendous perseverance, because the energies of doubt or the energies of resentment or the energies of worry are so programmed into the mind, they just keep coming back. You know, the world just keeps blown, you know, just keeps coming up, growing or coming into existence. And you have to be very, very diligent, say, no, delusion, 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 and keep coming back to the present moment. And if you persevere in that, then quite often what happens is the tendency of our consciousness to be in thought, in the head, always up in the head, in the eye, and so on. You find that your consciousness comes more down into your body, into your heart, into presence, actually, into presence, rather than the tendency for thought and the sense of self and ego always be past, future, past, future, past, future. If you really observe how your consciousness works, how much of the time is spent past, future? If you observe it, how much time is like reviewing what happened, what I should have done and what they shouldn't have done to me, and the future, how I'm going to handle it and how it's going to be good, bad, or indifferent. So much of our attention is preoccupied with that, and that's preoccupation with the world. But to be available and watchful, you have to be present. Right? You have to let go of this tendency of past and future. So we really emphasize present moment awareness, but how do you do that? You know, that's a kind of almost like a cliche now, isn't it, in New Age things and modern things. Be here now. Ram Dass, and what was that, 45 years ago he wrote that book, Be Here Now. And now he's had a stroke and he's written a book called Still Here Now, right? The Be Here Now is very easy to say, and we've had, a few decades to give it a go, but still, I suspect it's a kind of elusive thing, isn't it? It's not so easy. So one has to make the intention, one has to make a very, very clear intention. And why do that? Why awaken to the present moment? Well, is it just about having a more heightened sensual experience? Sometimes people think it's that. You know, having a more, like eating something and eating it with total mindfulness so that you have more pleasure. Well, that's not really what it's about. It's not about more pleasure, because you also have to be present to pain. Awake to pain, awake to various forms of discontent. No, it's really about finding the place in consciousness which is not dependent on the world, you know, which is not really a function of that kind of changing quality, and that's the peace of awareness, the peace of non-grasping, the peace of non-craving. So there has to be some kind of understanding of why did we do this. If someone just says to me, oh, you should be in the present moment, and I don't have any sense of why or the purpose of it, then I wouldn't really put any kind of mind, kind of intelligent effort forth. But if I see that attachment to the world, attachment to these habits of thinking and worrying and problem making and other me making, they describe it as my making. So when I say if I'm annoyed at someone else, then I'm creating me and them, aren't I? If I'm thinking about what I'm going to the future, there's a creation of me, I making my making, aham, aham, ahankara mimankara. But when you just stop and you just listen, and there's no creation in that. You're not creating the sound of that fan. There's no sense of I creating that. There is the stopping of that. There's the stopping of the world, the ending of the world, into the peace which lies between a thought, between this creation, between craving, between our resentments. These are not permanent things. They seem constant. They can seem constant, but actually they're simply energies that keep flashing into consciousness. So to appreciate the gap, the space, to appreciate watchfulness, availability, this kind of subtlety of mind, requires a kind of disillusionment with your thinking mind, I think, huh? A kind of non-trusting of your thinking mind. Because the thinking mind is very persuasive. It can really persuade you into all kinds of nasty corners of your consciousness. It can really persuade you about what other people really are like. Can't it? You know, our views and opinions that we have about other people and what they are and what they should be. Or your thinking mind can really persuade you about yourself, that you are this way and you're that way, you shouldn't be this way and you shouldn't be that way. But it's just thought. That's all it is. It's just a thought. It's just a perception. It's just the world coming up. And trusting in that, trusting that it's just a thought. Even the most horrible thought you might have about yourself, that you are like the total basket case in all the universe that's ever manifested, the worst possible human being ever, and you notice that as a thought. Keep the precepts, this is a good idea, or it might be justified. But just, you know, anything you create yourself as, I'm great, I'm not great, I'm hopeless, I'm better than, they're better than me, I'm just as good as them, they're just as good as me, that's just a thought. And then when you notice that thought, that's what we mean by the world. And when you don't attach to that and you don't believe in that, then there is no me and mine in that sense. There's still a sense of presence and consciousness, sure, but there isn't no kind of me and mine, there's just the silent knowing of the way things are. There's just watchful, available. It's a very lovely, very, very lovely place. You know, sometimes we're so enthralled or deluded by our thinking mind or fooled by our thinking mind that we go into other thoughts of how we shouldn't be deluded by our thinking mind. So I'll be maybe feeling some kind of negative emotion of aversion. And then I'll start thinking why I shouldn't feel the negative emotion of aversion, and then I'll analyze why I'm thinking that I shouldn't have the negative feeling of emotion, and then I'll analyze why I should not be thinking that I'm thinking about my negative, and it goes on and on and on. And that's just more thought. That's just the same world, isn't it? So just let go. Don't make it a problem. Often I'd go to Ajahn Sumedho with something like that, and he said, don't think about it. And I said, it can't be that easy, can it? But it was an easy solution, but hard to enact, because the driven nature of thought, driven by habit and the patterns of self and emotion, you have to be very diligent, don't you? You have to be really, really not. Don't believe it. Not self. Delusion. Don't go there. And this is not repression. It's not saying that this doesn't exist, but it's just not believing in it. Sometimes people think that this is repressive. Repression would be if you're not feeling it. You know it's there. You know what it feels like. But it's just not believing it, not making a problem, not creating a self around it. And this is where the teachings of not self make a lot of sense. Not self doesn't mean that there's nothing. You know, that just means that this particular formation, this world which has arisen, is not any essential you or other. This perception I have of someone else is not really them. Sure, it might have some accuracy, but it's no real fixed person called self or other. Because these beings are, you know, very complex. Human beings are very complex. And just kind of constantly coming back to that watchful, available quality of consciousness again and again and again puts us in touch with the world, really puts us in touch with people, puts us in touch with our hearts, puts us in touch with, I think, true communication, because we really listen, you know, we're really more plugged in. We notice more, both of ourselves and others. But if we're just believing constantly in the ego thinking mind and the world that it creates, then they can create some pretty heavy places. And yet, green is green, wind is the wind, the taste of bread is like the taste of bread. It's just that way. Yeah? And then coming back to that simplicity seems almost like cheating sometimes. Like if someone is like seriously into self-hatred, and then just to taste of the bread, just for the sake of tasting the bread, seems like, no, that can't be right. I should beat myself up a little bit. Or worry, or, you know, whatever it likes to present. And no, it's just this way. It's a very simple kind of suggestion, but try it and see, you know, we all try it, and that's why we're here, but it's actually quite an interesting challenge. It's quite an interesting challenge. So our meditation practices can help us, our determinations to live good, ethical, moral lives, you know, these are very, very helpful. But there is a sense of no longer believing in the self-created world, that whole world of perception. So I can be walking from A to B and be a beautiful day and nothing, you know, I've had enough food and everything, and yet my mind might be caught by some kind of negativity, and that is the world, isn't it? That's the world. And it's not that it's not real. I mean, it affects you. It affects the way I perceive others. I perceive everything around me. It's not that it's not real. We're just saying it's reality is very famous. It's more like a soap bubble. Just if you can burst it constantly. Now, sometimes, of course, the power of these worlds, as it were, as they arise, are driven by very, very difficult energy. So if someone cheats me, you know, and I lose my half of my pension because someone sucked me into a Ponzi scheme or something like that, that would be very, very worrying. It'd be very, very worrying, and I'd have to do something about it. And I maybe hoped about my pension, and now my pension is halved, and so on. So that would be a very powerful force of disappointment, to say the least. But still, the practice would be the same. Even if I really hated the person who had cheated me, and I was really, really worried about the future because my pension is threatened, it'd still be the same practice. It'd just be very, very intense, maybe. Maybe not. But probably, yeah. Probably would be. The nicest example I've had of that is there was a man called Siri who was lived in Ubon in Ajahn Chah's province, and he was a tailor, and he worked up in Ubon when the Americans had an air base near Ajahn Chah's monastery, and they would bomb Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos. Cambodia and Laos, I think. What a nice place. And he was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, a very faithful disciple, and he got into he was a tailor, and he was, I think, doing a lot of work with American soldiers. But eventually the army base was disbanded when the war ended, and the Americans left, and he went down to Bangkok and looked for other livelihood, and he found himself a man who taught him the gem business. And this man was very, very good to him and taught him all about the gem trade, and he became a gem merchant in Bangkok and became quite successful. And then this same man who had taught him one day came to him after maybe he had been in the business 10 years and said, I'm really short on liquidity, I'm short on funds, and I need a few million baht. And Siri totally trusted this man and gave him most of the money he had, without any kind of collateral, without any written document or whatever. And so this supposed friend then took the money and went to America and never came back. Lost it all. Got wiped out. Totally wiped out. And so I met him a year later. And he told me the story. And I said, wow, are you still angry? He said, well, I was in the beginning. But then I thought, well, maybe I owe him $3 million from a past life. And he let it go. I thought, well, that's cool, isn't it? He used his cultural ideas of karma to let it go. Now, sometimes we don't have those kind of cultural ideas, but letting go is important. So how do we do letting go? How do we let go of worry and yet be responsible in our planning? How do we let go of self-hatred and yet have a sense of self-criticism so that we grow? How do we let go of various forms of greed for things and whatever, and yet not become wet blankets and not enjoy some aspects of the beauty of life? How do we let go of resentments and yet still be cautious with people who are untrustworthy? So the world on that level, on the level of living this life in terms of money and planning, that still has to happen. That world needs to be addressed. So we need to be practical. Trust in Allah and tie your camel. But that world which we're pointing to in this lokavidu kind of reflection is the world of ego, I guess. That would be the best way to think of it. The world which is created as a perception of self and other. The more we let go of that, the more we can be in touch with the natural things of life and have a sense of caution and have friendships which are helpful in worldly ways and make investments into all of those things. So it's not dismissing that. It's just pointing to this possibility of not always having to be in the sense of always becoming and being reborn. Not in future lives, but right now. It's always a sense of being reborn into resentment or reborn into worry. Or it's very painful, isn't it? It's very painful and very kind of unfortunate part of human consciousness. And yet, at any given moment, you can stop, listen, feel, touch, taste. You can use those senses. Not to get rid of thought, but just to know, yeah, there's thought and there's salty. There's thought and there's humidity. And you just touch, the humidity feels this way. So like I felt, like in the meditation, I felt it was stuffy. So stuffy is an unpleasant feeling for me. So stuffy wanted to go to thought. So stuffy wanted to create the world. So then it wants to go to thought and say, should I or shouldn't I? Should I put the fan on or not? Why didn't they open the window? No. And that's rebirth. That's the world being born. There was the world of me and my stuffiness. And then the thoughts are coming. No, that's not. So it's easy to let go of. You just notice that and say, oh, stuffy feels this way. Hot feels this way. Now, if there was a fire, right, and smoke feels this way, burning feels this way, then obviously I do something because that's the normal world. But just to stop and notice, like disappointment. Someone disappoints you and then you feel disappointment feels this way, and then the mind wants to go, yeah, it's not fair, and I was really good to them, and then, that's the world being born. So yeah, disappointment feels this way. Then you can still say to the person, that's inappropriate. But it doesn't come from ego, it doesn't come from self, it doesn't come from aversion, and doesn't create all that mess that the mind can get caught up into. And this is happening all the time through the disappointments we have and the excitements that might come to us. And at any given moment, we can let go of all that. We can let go into the present moment, into watchful and available. So find yourself... make intentions to do this. Make clear intentions that this is the practice. The practice isn't to always be a person who never have has negative emotions, because that's not human. So to say I'm never, I'm not going to get angry all day, or I'm not going to get upset, well, good luck. But maybe you will. Maybe we'll get angry. So that's just anger. It just feels that way. These are bodies that feel emotions. So when we get poked, we react, and that's okay. But does it create a world? Does it create a sense of self? And I think one of the things I always contemplate, how long, and I often say this, how long does that perpetuate in consciousness? Does it go on for days? And days and days and days? Or hours? Or is it just momentary? Oh, I know that. So the ones that go on for days and days and days, these are deep-rooted habits. And we just have to really pay attention. Just keep letting go, letting go. And letting go is actually letting be. Letting go is letting be. This is the way it is now. It's a practice which requires a lot of inner vigilance, doesn't it? You have to be very vigilant about your mind. But not critical. It's not like you're always criticizing yourself. That's harsh. That's a kind of tyranny that we can do to ourselves. It's more a vigilance of the way things are, and then seeing the world and just seeing the end of the world. Well, that's the end. And it comes up again. No, that's the end. Don't believe it. Delusion. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Then the mind begins to taste the silence and peace of the mind more and more often. All right. I'll leave that for your reflection.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.